So tonight I'm going to speak about upekkha, Pali word translated as equanimity, the 10th of the 10 paramis. So it's the top of the list. First of all, I want to say that really I think metta and upekkha, loving kindness and equanimity, are sort of equally on top of the list. They're sort of a balanced pair. One is more heart-centered, one is more, mental process-centered, and we need to have that balance of heart and mind to perfect things. So I want to make sure you understand that they're equal, and I spoke about metta yes last time, and this time I'm going to speak about equanimity. The other thing I want to mention is this isn't the only list where equanimity is at the top of the list. There's two other ones in particular, though there are other places as well. But the two others that I'm very familiar with are the four Brahma Viharas, the noble abodes. The last of those four is equanimity, and this equanimity is said to balance the other three. And it's also the last item on the seven factors of awakening, which is one of the central teachings of the Buddha in the Satipatthana Sutta, where the Buddha is describing the process we go through mentally once mindfulness is established, it, that we move to higher places, more focused places, more concentrated places, and we end up at equanimity. So the Buddha thought this was pretty important to put it in those three quite prominent places and put it at the top of all those lists. So as I read things from various sources, sometimes the source will reference the Brahma Viharas or the seven factors of awakening. They're all coming from the same place, and then its equanimity is important in all these places. This is from Sharon Salzberg's book, Loving Kindness. And she's talking about this balance. Equanimity is taught as the final meditation among the Brahma Viharas because it provides the balance for loving kindness, compassion, and sympathetic joy. So those are the other three Brahma Viharas, right? And equanimity is seen as like keeping things in balance. For instance, with compassion, without the balancing power of equanimity, compassion can quickly turn into, being overwhelmed. And it's the equanimity that keeps us away from the overwhelm energy of compassion. This is a for instance. These others open one's heart in the wish for well-being. May you be happy, may you be free from suffering, may your joy never cease. Equanimity balances these heartfelt wishes with the recognition that things are the way they are. However much we may wish for something, most results are beyond our control. So it's like the note of realism in the whole teaching, in a sense. So I want to actually read it out. A really great definition, because you see all these different versions of what equanimity is. So this definition I think is really helpful. This is once again from Sharon Salzberg. Equanimity is a spacious stillness of mind, a radiant calm that allows us to be present fully with all the different changing experiences that constitute our world in our lives. And I really like this definition because she hits several really important things. The first one is she starts with the phrase that equanimity is a spacious stillness. So when you're in a state of equanimity, your mind is still, but it's spacious. It hasn't closed down. In fact, it's wide open. You're open to whatever is arising, but you stay steady, this whatever's arising. We don't get distracted and pulled off in various directions. So there's basically, there's room when the mind is a quantumist, there's room for anything that arises in the mind without exception. There's room for all of it. And nothing's rejected. Nothing's like, oh, well, I can't have that in my mind. It's like it doesn't work that way. It's like everything is okay. I want to read. I've got several things to read from Joseph Goldstein's book, Mindfulness, on this topic as well. This is the first of those. This is he's talking about equanimity here as one of the seven factors of awakening. Equanimity is one of the beautiful universals. Is the mental factor called neutrality of mind. Bhikkhu Bodhi said that the Pali term could literally be translated as there in the middleness. There in the middleness. Although this is an awkward construction in English, it does convey the balancing power of equanimity. Its characteristic is evenness, and when it is highly developed, it manifests as an unshakable balance of mind. It serves to prevent either deficiency or excess in the other mental factors. It's the balancing power. We keep coming back to this. So here's another definition I came across. There's, like I said, if you start digging into this, you'll come across lots of different versions of it. This is from a woman named Rebecca Bradshaw. And here she says, equanimity is a continuous accommodation to the truth of the present moment. An accommodation to the truth of the present moment. An equanimous heart mind can connect with this world and all its changes with balance, poise, grace, and flexibility. With equanimity, we can learn to trust deeply and relax into our capacity to flow with the river of change. You know, the river of change being that constant flow of things that are arising at our sense doors and our inner, both in our mind and in our bodily senses. That just is endless. Right? And it gives us, we learn to trust deeply and relax into our capacity to flow with the river of change. So we don't get swept away. Another aspect of Sharon's definition, and that's the phrase where she says that this is a radiant calm. So not only is your mind focused and still, if you're equanimous, but you literally become a source of this wholesome mind state for others around you. You radiate this powerful energy. If you've ever been around people who are deeply, deeply practiced, I think of my longtime teacher, Guy Armstrong, is the person I think of when I think of this. It's like there's just something about these people that is different. It's the only way, the only words I can use it. They feel different. There's something like, it's calming just to be in the same room with them. And it's just that they're radiating this energy, literally. This is where the practice leads us, leads us to be radiators of calmness and loving kindness. Seems like a good idea to me anyway. Yeah. And this is my answer to those people who say, you know, this meditation stuff, it's really selfish. You're just going to sit there and, you know, gaze at your navel or whatever you're doing. And you're just doing this for yourself. And I think instead, wait, wouldn't it be great if we had more people who radiated calmness and radiated loving kindness? Wouldn't that be a good thing for the world? And that's what the practice creates, is people who are like that. That's where we're all headed in our own small way. Gradually, small, slow, slow, slow. I've been in a conversation with, I'm a chaplain at the hospital, and they're setting up a group at the hospital called the Nobody Dies Alone, to have people go and actually sit with people who are literally in the very end stage. The last 72 hours, you can usually tell it. People reach a certain point when they're dying where it's like, oh, it's fairly soon now, because there's certain signs, physical signs, that start to arise quite clearly. And so what we're going to do and is have people come and just sit with these people. Not do anything other than just literally be the calm energy in the room with this person. I've done a lot of this. I used to do hospice work, and I did a lot of vigil sitting with people at this point. And it's a very powerful practice form, number one. And I certainly thought of, whenever I was sitting vigil, I was like, oh, I'm just doing my practice. But it's like the essential thing is that these people, when they go in and sit, have to be equanimous. Or as best they can be equanimous. They have to sort of just be there. And it's such a powerful gift to give both to the person that's dying, but also to the family that's often there, and also to the staff around this situation. We would often do this sitting in nursing homes and places where people were living, skilled nursing facilities and places like that. And the staff was always like so happy when people came to sit vigil with their patients, because it's sort of, oh, this person's not going to be alone. It's anyhow, and just this is sort of an aside, because it's in my mind, because I just had this long meeting yesterday, how we're going to actually make this happen. And I'm kind of excited, actually, to be honest with you. Anyhow. Finally, in Sharon's definitions, there's this phrase, to be fully present with all the different changing experiences. To be fully present with all the different changing experiences. This could be a definition of not suffering. We suffer because we cling to things that arise that you find pleasant, and we try and avoid and push away things we don't want. We don't flow with the river of change, as Rebecca Bradshaw said. We don't understand or accept that everything is impermanent, constantly changing, and if you're equanimous, you no longer suffer. It's like the base level of no longer suffering is to not be constantly caught by what's arising. And it's another way to say this is that you reach the state of no longer being reactive to the what's arising in at your sense stores, in your mind and in your body. Here's the tricky part, one of the tricky parts. Indifference is a state of mind that masquerades as equanimity, literally. I mean, you see people who are indifferent. And the problem here is that especially if you're people like me who reads things and studies text, you'll often see the Pali word upekkha, or the Sanskrit word upeksham, which is the same thing, translated not as equanimity, but as indifference. So this is a serious mistranslation that has gone and is being perpetuated in the texts. And outwardly, indifference looks the same. And the person's just sitting there, and it's like they're very calm and still, and a little smile on their face. But indifference is a rejection of the world. It's a sense of, I don't care, which is the it isn't spacious at all. It isn't, in fact, it's quite narrow. It's like, who cares? It's sort of narrow and self-serving. I, you know, All that stuff that's going on, I don't care. I'm not going to be involved. I'm just going to be totally indifferent to the whole thing. This is not equanimity in any sense of the word. It doesn't accommodate the present moment, to use Sharon's definition. It ignores it. Just, whatever's happening, who cares? Equanimity is infused with loving kindness. Equanimity has to be infused with loving kindness as a sense of caring for all beings. So when you're equanimous, your heart has to be wide open, taking it all in and not being reactive to it. And being that state of mind has to be infused with loving kindness. This is something from this book Parami I've been reading from. This is Ajahn Susito, and he's talking about this topic in his usual casual style. Outside of contemplative circles, equanimity is not highly rated. In fact, it's not really understood at all. True enough, the Pali word upekkha can mean neutral in terms of feeling. It can give the impression that one is indifferent and doesn't care, a nonchalant, laissez-faire attitude. But this is stupid equanimity. That's his definition of indifference. I like it. Stupid equanimity. There's nothing furthering in it. Nonchalance carries delusion that does not fully acknowledge the feeling or the consequences of mind states. It's an escape in which one gets vague and fuzzy. It's a defense. It's not wanting to feel, which is understandable when you consider how many terrible things you can witness through the media every day. So instead of fellow feeling and empathy, people pass comment, philosophize, or talk about suffering as if it's a statistic. Sure enough, being aware and tuned in and still remaining equanimous isn't easy. And I want to read this to acknowledge that, because this is like to be truly non-reactive is a incredible accomplishment, actually. It's not something that we just sort of can do. Oh, I think I'll be equanimous today. It takes years and years of practice, and even then we get thrown. Even then we get thrown. So what about equanimity in our daily life? And I think this is an important thing we have to think about, because all of these paramis are should be reflected in how we live our lives in the world, right? So once again, I want to read something else from Joseph here. And he's talking about this very topic. And this is in a section called Equanimity as a Quality of Balance, balance in our lives in the world, right? The first way we experience the cool, restful quality of equanimity is in the peace and balance it brings to our daily lives. Each of us is touched by what are called the eight worldly vicissitudes. These are the endlessly changing conditions of pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute, and pleasure and pain. When equanimity is developed, we ride these waves with balance and ease. Without it, we're tossed about by the waves, often crashing into the changing circumstances of our own lives. So this is yet another of these famous Buddhist lists, right? But it's one that we should spend some time thinking about if we really want to understand what equanimity is. So these are the eight things, and these are four pairs of things, actually. So the first pair is gain and loss. Often thought of in physical financial terms, but it's also is very relevant to our practice and to our lives, our daily lives in the world. Think of this in terms of the practice for a start. We all have a regular sitting practice, right? And we have a day, or maybe a series of days, or it's based period of time even, where things are just great. We have a really good sit, right? And then what happens? Oh, then the next day or the next week or sometime further on down the line, it isn't like that. But when we think we've had a good sit, like we've gained something, it's special, and then it goes away. Then we have loss. I thought I'd got this stuff figured out, and now I can't sit still for 30 seconds. Whereas before I could be sit there with a big smile on my face and be calm and still the whole time. This is gain and loss. This is the first of the two, first of these pairs of four things. And we try and figure out what we're doing wrong. How come it's gone? What have I done wrong? And so we just create yet more suffering. Not only do we feel the pain of having lost something, but then we go through the painful process of trying to figure out what went wrong. Like somehow I've messed up. When the truth is, things go up and down. Things we have good sits and we have bad sits. And even to call them good sits and bad sits is a dangerous thing, but it is like common because that's the language we use. We should more and more we should just try and think we have sits. Sometimes that sit is peaceful and calm and still and focused and very sweet. And sometimes it's total chaos. And that's just the nature of the practice. There's nothing wrong with either of those. The total chaos, sometimes we learn from the total chaos. Like that if I can have it sit, it's total chaos, but note the fact that I'm in total chaos. This can be a really skillful experience. There's nothing wrong with chaos. It's just we don't like it. It's unpleasant. It isn't like that nice calm space I had yesterday. It's just what arose today. And if we're equanimous, all of those things are okay. Both the beautiful, glorious times and the train wreck times, the chaos times, equally okay. Then we got the next pair. Praise and blame. So it's easy to get caught up in feeling good about praise and feeling bad about blame. Both of those reactions, feeling good about praise and bad about blame, are just ways we create more of a sense of a separate self. They're praising me, and we think, I really got that one, Or we get blamed for something, and it's like, who do they think they are? I'm bummed. They don't know what I. They don't really know me. Blah 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 blah. We go into all those little internal rants about things when that happens. It's just stuff that's arising in other people's minds. Praise and blame are also not in your mind. They're in other people's minds, and as they express them, well, all that's happening is you're being reactive to them. And if you're reactive to them in either direction, you've no longer equanimous. You're caught up by something. And it's like, I'm not saying, you shouldn't feel good about yourself when someone says something nice to you. But don't think like the danger is we start thinking, well, everybody should see that. Everybody should know how wonderful I am, right? And now we're just caught. Or the reverse of that, when you get blamed, oh, someone actually sees me for who I really am. I'm such a rotten person, and we get into that, beat ourselves up cycle. Equally not useful. It's just stuff in other people's minds they're expressing in words or actions. that don't reflect who you really are anyway. It reflects where their minds are. And all we have to do is not be reactive to it. The next pair, fame and disrepute. This is, my notes here say, praise and blame writ large. You know, they only exist as thoughts in other people's mind. You're famous, or you're falling into disrepute. That's just other people's thoughts about you. It's all it is. But it's so easy to seek fame and to avoid disrepute to the point of like telling small untruths about what was actually happening so that it doesn't look, you don't look so bad sort of level, right? Or, but the thing about fame is like our whole culture is like a culture of fame. You know, think about what you see in the media every day, whether you follow the sports media or the entertainment media or the political media or whatever it is. They're all about people being famous or falling into disrepute. Often the same person at different times, of course, you know, because that's also the cycle. You know, someone's famous and then they're all of a sudden this really rotten person who didn't blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it's just the cycles of other people's minds glomming onto people at the group level, like, well, everybody else thinks this guy's important, so he must be important, so I'm going to think that he's, you know, and now this person becomes famous. Just like that. It's also, this is one of those ones where we have to watch, we don't want fame. It's, I mean, I have had moments, little, small, short, and then I laugh at myself right away, but I still have these moments where I think, wouldn't it be nice if some like celebrity discovered me and, you know, I got invited to Hollywood and I could teach at their mansion on the hill in Hollywood to all these other famous people. And then I go, God, I'd hate that. But the initial idea is like, wow, wouldn't that be cool? I'd become this famous Dharma teacher in Hollywood and blah, 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 blah. What? It's like total nonsense. Total nonsense. But that's where the mind goes. The mind thinks that wouldn't that, you know, for a moment or two, it's like, wouldn't that be great to be famous like that? Just, God, it would be horrible, I'm sure. I mean, can you imagine going to Hollywood and trying to teach people Dharma? It would be scary. Anyhow, it's just the thought that arises in my mind. And then I laugh at it and away it goes again. Luckily, I can laugh at it. So the final of these pair, pleasure and pain. Changes are inevitable. You know, we get some pleasure and then we get some pain. This is simply the cycle of life. Perfectly natural. And not our fault, or not what we, you know, when we get pleasure, we think we deserved it. No, we don't. It just happens. When we get pain, we think we did something wrong and we're being punished. No, we didn't. It just happened. Pleasure and pain are just the natural cycle of life. It's all they are. And when we're reactive to them, either trying to hold on to them, we're trying to push them away, trying to think we're important because we have a lot of pleasure going on right now, or God, we must be really horrible because we're full of pain. It's all our fault. It's just being caught. It's being not being equanimous. So it's a pretty good definition of not being equanimous, being caught by these two. So this is, and these, I like this list because it's things we can sort of, in our practice, both in life and in our sitting practice, we can sort of see ourselves being caught by these things. Like just getting caught up in, like I'm saying, I'm just sitting there innocently practicing, and this whole idea about being a famous Dharma teacher in Hollywood, this is there. I didn't make it happen. It there was. And it's like, oh, it's just that crazy idea again. And then you can just laugh at it and it goes away and your mind goes nice and calm and heads towards calm, more calm and more still again. That's just the nature of mind and practice. Okay, so now equanimity is a like all of the other paramis, and like the other three Brahma Viharas, and like the seven factors of awakening. All of these things are practice. These are forms. These are things we can act. We can actually practice being equanimous. And like the other Brahma Viharas, there's a phrase you can use that you can repeat over and over that helps you sort of tune into the qualities of equanimity. I'll tell you the phrase, and I want to talk about what it means and how we have to pay attention to what this phrase means. So the phrase is, you are the owner of your karma. Your happiness or unhappiness depends on your actions, not on my wishes for you. I'll repeat that. You are the owner of your karma. Your happiness or unhappiness depends on your actions, not on my wishes for you. And of course, this could be put into the first person words, like, I am the owner of my karma. My happiness or unhappiness depends on my actions, not on my wishes for myself. This is a really clear statement. And we have to think about how we get caught in not being equanimous by not paying attention to this, what this phrase means. And, in general, we can sort of, maybe we might be able to sort of philosophically sit back and go, yeah, I can see that. Makes sense. But now, think of this in the context of someone close to you, your partner, your child, someone a really close friend, and think, well, what does that mean? When you think of that person and you think, you are the owner of your karma, your happiness or unhappiness depends on your actions, not on my wishes for you. Oh, I what this is saying is, you can't make that person happy. Period. You can't make that person happy. I mean, you can do things that create the causes and conditions such that they may become happy or may stay happy. That you can do, and that's a wholesome thing to do. But you can't be responsible for someone else's happiness. It's hard enough being responsible for your own happiness. And this has, when we talk about people we're close to, this is like, oh, because so often in our relationships, our close relationships, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to make them happy because they're in a bad mood, they're grumpy or whatever, and we try and make them happy, often causing more suffering in the process. Or vice versa, we're in a sad and grumpy mood, and we expect them to make us happy. Neither of these ever work in the long run. And I'm not, like I said, I'm not saying we can't do wonderful, sweet things with people who we're close to. But we have to do them without any expectation that it's actually going to make them happy. And not get upset when it doesn't make them happy. These are not equanimous actions. Non-autonomous mind spaces. You do something because you think, oh, this person's going to be really happy when I do this. And then they react, either they don't react at all, or they might even react like, what are you doing that nonsense for? Or whatever. We can't have, you can't have any expectations. This is a hard place in the practice because it's so, it seems so natural in our day-to-day world that that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to make people happy. We're trying to keep ourselves from getting unhappy by having other people make us happy. Neither of these are equanimous and neither of them actually work. So, but it's an interesting place to practice with this phrase. I mean, if you think about someone and you're trying to, if you catch yourself in the space of trying to make someone happy, just stop, pause, and literally repeat that phrase in your mind 10 times with that person in your mind and see how it changes that energy. It's a very powerful practice. It's not easy because it's so against what we want to be. We want to be, we also a big part of this is we want to be looked upon as the person who makes people happy. Don't we all want that? I want to be the person who makes people happy. It's like a natural thing to want to do. But in the end, all we can do is, like I said, and this, I'm being pedantic perhaps, but we can create causes and conditions such that the potential for happiness arising in that person's sphere increases. That much I can own. I can do what I can to create those causes and conditions. But if as soon as I get caught in the expectation that it's actually going to make a difference, that's when we get into trouble. That's when we suffer. Because it doesn't always work, or it doesn't work at all sometimes. It just doesn't. And we've lost equanimity when we get caught in that desire, which really what it is a desire to make someone else happy. We have to be careful. This is a place where, in our day-to-day world, where a lot of our suffering arises right out of this place. So here's one other interesting thing, and this is where I'm talking back about it's the significance of this, what I've been saying in terms of our actual meditation practice. It's from this state of equanimity, when we're in this equanimous mind state, which is it's a mental arising. It's something that arises just like mindfulness and concentration and joy. It's a wholesome mind state, and it arises, and it's going to be there for a while, and then it's going to be gone. It's like everything else, so we have to understand that too. But when the mind is equanimous, that's when it's most likely that we'll start to really see clearly the three characteristics as they arise. The three characteristics, of course, being we experience the rising and passing away of everything. Everything, we just start always seeing, and we're not sort of caught up in the content of what's arising anymore. We're just seeing that there's something, it's there. Oh, no, it's gone. Oh, there's another thing. And there's just one thing after another arising. And we're in that stream. We're not fighting against the stream. We're just aware of the stream of these things arising and passing away. And we see, and we don't, without getting attached to any of those things or pushing them away. And out of that, we see that everything in that stream is unreliable in the sense of creating permanent happiness. It's unreliable because it's going to change for sure. In that sense, it's unreliable. And then we start to see, wait, if all there is this stream of constantly changing phenomena. That's really all we're ever experiencing. When we're equanimous, we start to see that that's all we're ever experiencing. Where's the self in all that? Where's the, if there's no self there. There's no one home. This is where we can start to actually see that, as opposed to sort of understand it intellectually. We start to experience the lack of a separate self, because all we're experiencing is this constantly changing stream of experience. That's all that's ever there. When we get calm and still enough, we can actually see this, as opposed to think about it, intellectualize about it. I have a couple more things to read here. This is once again from Ajahn Sasito's book Parami, and he has a. I like what he says here, because it's a once again a different view of what I've been talking about. But so equanimity is a deep humility. I'd never, until I read this a couple of days ago as I was preparing for this talk, I'd never thought of equanimity in that context. So equanimity is a deep humility that allows the mind to step out of adopting any identity, any view, any judgment. With evenness of mind, the intentions of wisdom and relinquishment make the choice to abandon the cause of suffering, and kindness and compassion encourage others to do the same. Seems like a worthy goal in life. I don't want to read this again. It's just a brilliant sentence. So equanimity is a deep humility that allows the mind to step out of adopting any identity, any view, any judgment. With evenness of mind, the intentions of wisdom and relinquishment, of letting go of things, make the choice to abandon the cause of suffering, and kindness and compassion encourage others to do the same. That's a pretty good description of someone operating from an equanimous space. I think the world could use a lot more of that myself. One more little piece from Joseph here, too. He's talking about equanimity as a source of wisdom. Third manifestation of equanimity takes us deep into the experience of meditative awareness. The wisdom aspect of equanimity is beautifully expressed in the famous opening lines of the Faith Mind by the third Zen ancestor. The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. When attachment and aversion are both absent, the way is clear and undisguised. Make the smallest distinction, however, and heaven and earth are infinitely apart. Practicing the Great Way, the equanimity of non-preferential awareness supports the development of all the awakening factors. As they become strong, we gain ever deeper insights into the three characteristics. We know the truth of change, not only as a conceptual understanding, but also as the direct experience of things arising and passing away. Sometimes this experience of impermanence is on a macro level, and then increasingly on a momentary micro level. At this point, our meditation is less involved in what it is that's arising, but with the process of change itself. We experience the truth of dukkha, the unreliability and unsatisfactory nature of conditioned phenomena. We see the continual dissolution of everything that arises. and at times even the momentary dissolution of consciousness itself. So even consciousness disappears. It's just some other thing. And now I'm out of my territory of experience, to be honest with you. But this is, obviously Joseph understands this because he's experienced it. And this talk, I love talking about equanimity. It has, I have to finish with not one poem, but two. Because there's this, this doesn't, it deserves more than one poem, right? So this is from Dana Falds, and it's called Remember This. Vast and changeless, the ground of being is not rocked by ripples on the pond. The firmament from which we spring, the divinity at the heart of things, doesn't wax or wane with mind states or wither in the wind. We come from stronger stuff than feelings. Essence does not fail or fade, diminish or trade reality for illusion. We are wordless, wide, and wise beyond time. Within us is a flame of truth that never dies. Let that be the focal point of life. Let that be the light that guides us from the shadows. Within us is a flame of truth that never dies. And then this is from Mary Oliver's book, Evidence. And this is just the last section of a longer poem, which is called To Begin With the Sweet Grass. But I'm just going to, I don't want to read the whole poem, but this last section has always moved me. Because she's talking about the same thing again. What I loved in the beginning, I think, was mostly myself. Never mind that I had to, since somebody had to. That was many years ago. Since then, I've come out from my confinements, though with difficulty. I mean the ones that thought to rule my heart. I cast them out. I put them on the mush pile. They will be nourishment somehow. Everything is nourishment somehow or another. And I have become a child of the clouds and of hope. I have become the friend of the enemy, whoever that is. I have become older, and cherishing what I have learned, I have become younger. And what do I risk to tell you this, which is all I know? Love yourself. Then forget it. Then love the world. Sounds like she's writing from a very equanimous place to me.